You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Hi, everybody. My name is Justin Vase. I'm the Director of Research for the Center in the U.S. and Europe. And it's my pleasure to welcome all of you at Brookings this morning. I'm very happy you could join us for a conversation with Olli Rehn, the EU Commissioner for Economic and Financial Affairs. This discussion this morning is held in the context of our partnerships with our friends at the Heinrich Böll Foundation. Together in the past few months, we've been discussing the issue of the euro. We've held a number of workshops and roundtable on the eurozone situation. And we've also worked in tandem with the EU delegation here on K Street. And I would like to extend a special welcome to Ambassador Valle de Almeida, who's joining us today. We only have an hour and a half, and even less than that, so I'll be very brief in my introduction. In Commissioner Olli Rehn, we have a very distinguished official who's been at the heart of the European project for the past 7 years in the two Barroso commissions, enlargement and then currency and the economy. So first he was a commissioner for enlargement at a crucial moment when the EU expanded dramatically and also conducted difficult negotiation with candidate countries. Then, starting a bit more than a year ago in February 2010, he was Commissioner for Economic and Financial Affairs amidst one of the worst global financial crises ever, at a time when the euro was rumored to be gravely imperiled and threatening to take the whole European integration project down with it. So that was a pretty brutal beginning. But I guess Commissioner Rehn was well-armed because before assuming his functions in the Barroso Commission and even briefly in the Prodi Commission, Olli Rehn had been had an accomplished political career both in Finland and in the EU institutions as a member of the European Parliament in the 1990s and as head of the cabinet of the Finnish commissioner. He also had experience in the private sector and in the academic world, briefly running the Center for European Studies at the University of Helsinki. So we not only have the best person to tell us about the Eurozone and Europe's position in the world economy, but also someone who's really been a key witness at a central position in the past 10 or 15 years. As for the context, it is well known to all of you, I'm sure. On March 11, an extraordinary summit of the Eurogroup reached what was called a grand bargain, setting up a permanent fund for the assistance of ailing countries struck by a sovereign debt crisis, strengthening fiscal and economic coordination, as well as European governance. This decision was confirmed by a later summit by the entire European Union in late March, less than a month ago, and provided both a quick relief to the tensions on the euro and a long-term solution for future debt crisis. But of course, the question is, will this be sufficient? And we have at least two problems on the horizon. I shouldn't say on the horizon for Portugal, because a week ago, Portugal asked the help of the European Financial Stability Facility to face its debt problem. So, and the situation of some countries in the periphery is still a cause for great concern. And second, we know that the bank crisis had become a sovereign debt crisis, which, of course, officials are working on. But the bank situation is still not solved, with a round of stress tests ahead of us in Europe, and that is certainly another issue of concern. And at stake, of course, is not only the future of the euro, but the broader question of the tensions generated by this situation on the European project, and of course, the interaction between Europe and the rest of the world. In the recent IMF world economic outlook, some concern with Europe, and in particular with the Eurozone, was expressed, and so that's one of the points that I'm sure Olli Rehn will be able to discuss. And he will also address the sort of more broad question of the global recovery and Europe's role and part in the global recovery in the recent month and in the years ahead. After Commissioner Rehn has presented his preliminary remarks, I will ask Dan Hamilton, whom it's a pleasure to welcome this morning at Brookings, who's one of the most eminent specialists transatlantic relations on this side of the Atlantic and on the other side of the street, I would say. Dan Hamilton is the executive director of the Center for Transatlantic Relations, which is just across the street at Johns Hopkins University, and he's the executive director of the American Consortium of EU on EU Studies. He has recently authored and I should say recently because he's authoring them at a very rapid pace and it's hard to keep the rhythm. He has recently authored two important studies. One is one you probably know very well, which is the Transatlantic Economy, the version, the 2011 edition. And another one is a book that Commissioner Rehn presented a couple of weeks ago along with Dan, Europe 2020, Competitive or Complacent, and you'll find sort of mini versions of these books on the table outside. So I will ask Dan to provide a discussion and comments after Commissioner Rehn has spoken. So once again, Commissioner Rehn, it's really a pleasure to welcome you at Brookings, and we look forward to your remarks.
Thank you, Justin. Dan, ladies and gentlemen, let me first thank you for your very kind invitation to give a talk here at Brookings on a topic that has kept me very busy over the past year. In fact, as you, Justin, said, that it was a brutal start a year ago. It is true that I had to hit the ground landing when I started in this post about, 14 months ago. And I recall a discussion about a year ago with José Manuel Barroso, the president of the European Commission. He said we had a small meeting and we discussed the situation in Greece and the euro area and the crisis that was then folding and emerging. President Barroso asked me that, you know, Olli, what's wrong with you? When you started in this economic and monetary affairs portfolio, things started to be extremely turbulent and we immediately faced a turmoil in the financial markets and the eurozone. And I reflected a little and said, yes, you are right, but on the other hand, now we have extreme calm in the field of enlargement. So at least life is not boring and it is a very meaningful job to try to work out strategies to overcome this current crisis. The financial crisis has served as a very severe stress test for the euro area economy. Many commentators have claimed that our single currency has failed and have predicted a breakup of the eurozone. It is certainly true that we have lived through a period of serious stress, but the euro's critics are wrong to claim that this will lead to its failure or breakup. The euro area will not only survive, but is coming out of the crisis stronger than before. Once we have completed the ongoing reforms, completed our firefighting work and built a new economic and financial architecture, which is work that is currently going on. This is my key message today. I'm glad to discuss this once we move to the Q&A. And my key message is supported by five main arguments. First, we have shown our capacity to act and to contain the financial turbulence and have created effective financial stability mechanisms. Second, we are implementing a very systematic program of fiscal consolidation and undertaking in fact, unprecedented structural reforms in Europe. Third, we have identified the key weaknesses of EU economic governance. There are weaknesses, fully aware of that. We have identified these and we are addressing them in a way that will profoundly change the policy-making landscape in the European Union. And fourth, we are already seeing results in terms of economic recovery and increasing confidence. You have on the screens, you have some figures about the economic sentiment indicator, which shows that we are in fact now clearly back to the pre-crisis level of economic confidence, both in the euro area and the EU as a whole. And in terms of economic sentiment and recovery, we have clearly rebounded in the course of past year, and this rebound is now continuing. And fifth, the benefits and value of the euro for Europe are far larger and more significant than often appreciated by at least some of the euro's critics. So let me elaborate these five arguments and provide you some empirical evidence that this indeed is the case. Less than 12 months ago, Greece was about to default. We discovered that the country's public finances were in a much worse state than earlier known or assumed. While it took some time to recognize what was necessary and to get our act together, we did so decisively. The euro area, together with the IMF, approved a 110 billion euro conditional rescue package for Greece in early May last year. Only 1 week later, we created a 3-year financial stability mechanism with a community arm called the European Financial Stability Mechanism and an intergovernmental arm called the European Financial Stability Facility. All in all, with 500 billion euros of resources in terms of guarantees backing these mechanisms. Then, last November, Ireland's banking sector was about to implode, and that would have had devastating consequences for its public finances. In that moment, we were able to activate the new mechanism very swiftly. And last week, Portugal requested EU IMF financial assistance, and we can expect a support program to emerge in a matter of a few weeks. Our teams from the Commission, ECB and the IMF have just arrived to Lisbon earlier this week, and the negotiations on policy conditionality will start with full effect as of next Monday onwards. Of course, the turbulence in the sovereign debt markets is not over yet. And this slide provides you figures about developments in the sovereign debt markets from January 2007 until the recent days, and we are quite confident that with the Portuguese program we should be able to contain the problem, ring-fence the problem to the most vulnerable countries. It is noteworthy that the Portuguese request did not affect spreads in the neighbouring Spain, and indeed, as you can see from this chart, and indeed, it has been almost universally recognized now, latest by the IMF yesterday in today's papers, that Spain has decoupled from the other three countries. While I cannot say that mission accomplished by no means yet, I am increasingly confident that we are entering into the endgame of the crisis management phase. The European Financial Stability Mechanism and Facility are in force until 2013, mid-2013. After that, they will be replaced by a permanent European Stability Mechanism, ESM, which will safeguard financial stability in the euro area and contain three elements. First, of course, financial assistance. Second, always a conditional program of fiscal adjustment and structural reforms. And third, a possibility for private sector involvement. And all this based on an analysis of debt sustainability conducted together by the EU and the IMF. What has been achieved with these arrangements? By providing conditional financial assistance to soon three EU member states, we have prevented financial chaos in Europe, which could have led potentially, which could have had potentially serious global repercussions as well. Preventing a European Lehman has not been a simple task, with 27 fiscal authorities and 11 central banks in the European Union. You know, we never had the genius of Alexander Hamilton to draw on, like you did, unless you count Jack Delors also for that purpose. But nevertheless, the task has been accomplished. It is essential to note that it is not just financial assistance that is involved. The assistance is strictly conditional. A member state which makes a request has to put its public finances in order and take very difficult but equally necessary and often overdue structural reforms in the labour markets, pension systems, competition policy and many other areas. The assistance packages are in fact instruments for reforming some of the weakest and more vulnerable EU economies. This takes me to my second point. Europe is now addressing its challenges of public finances with rigor and vigor, led by the most vulnerable countries. And I'm glad to note that there is a similar endeavor starting also in the United States based on the speech of President Obama yesterday at George Washington University. The crisis has increased government debt in the euro area by some 20 percentage points to close to 90% of GDP by 2012, next year on average. This is somewhat lower than the comparable figure for the United States, which would include states and local governments. But we strongly believe that immediate action is needed to put debt on a declining path, not only on average, but in every single member state. And that is precisely what we are doing now. This year, every EU member state will reduce its budget deficit, and the consolidation is set to continue for years to come. Similarly, structural reforms are now being implemented with a new sense of urgency. This is key for unleashing higher potential growth in the long term and for raising employment prospects. Perhaps the best example is Spain, where the labour market, the pension system and the banking system, especially the savings banks sector, are now being reformed with the previously unseen determination, which has been appropriately recognized by the market and the investors, and by the way, also by the Chinese, Russian and Norwegian sovereign wealth funds that have recently returned Spain to the list of countries where they continue to invest in the bonds. Ladies and gentlemen, yet from the euro area perspective, the most significant thing that the crisis brought about is a complete overhaul of European economic policy governance. It is based on the following analysis of the problems or systemic weaknesses we experienced in the economic and monetary union over the past decade. Even if the EU has had what we call the Stability and Growth Pact to guard against imprudent fiscal policies of individual member states, the pact has not been sufficiently effective or strict enough. It has allowed countries to run high debt levels, thus making them vulnerable to adverse shocks. Greece, of course, is the most acute example of this kind of fiscal imprudence. Also, we paid only very little, if any, attention in our policy coordination to broader macroeconomic imbalances, such as weak competitiveness, high current account deficits, or credit and asset price bubbles. Nevertheless, we should not forget that these can cause severe problems not only for the member state in question, but also for the rest of the euro area or the union as a whole. Ireland and Spain are cases in point of this kind of macroeconomic imbalances. And finally, when even rules have existed, they have not been enforced with rigor, which was one of the fundamental weaknesses of the EMU Act 1 in the past decade. Now, all this is changing. We are about to put in place a comprehensive reform of economic governance in this summer. What will it mean? It will have two pillars and one foundation and one framework, which are illustrated on this slide. And the first of the two pillars is that in order to avoid the build-up of excessive deficits and debt, we will strengthen the Stability and Growth Pact by making the adjustment towards a medium-term budgetary objective operational and binding. And we will also revive the neglected debt criterion of the pact and focus much more on debt sustainability of the member states. Second, we will broaden economic surveillance to identify and address macroeconomic imbalances and divergences in competitiveness. When unsustainable developments are identified on the basis of a scoreboard of indicators, in-depth country analysis and country-specific recommendations will follow, initiated by the Commission and decided by the Council. There's, by the way, plenty of resemblance with our new mechanism and the currently planned mechanism for G20 in tackling global imbalances, with the important distinction that we have more bite and we have an enforcement mechanism also for this identification and addressing macroeconomic imbalances in the European Union. Third, to prevent unsustainable economic policies by member states, we will introduce stronger incentives and sanctions, which will kick in at an earlier stage of the surveillance process and which will be gradually tightened unless corrective action is taken by the member state concerned. Equally important, we want to make the consequences of irresponsible fiscal behavior more automatic we call this semi-automaticity, and thus less subject to political deliberation, i.e. political wheeling and dealing. One very important change has already been implemented from this year on, from this January onwards. The process of EU economic surveillance is conducted in the first half of the year through the so-called European semester. It will enable consistent policy guidance to member states early enough so that it can be taken into account by member states in the formulation of their national budgets for the following year. Right now, from April to June, we are in the process of doing this for the budgets of next year, 2012. With these changes, we are recasting our policy making in an essential way, particularly in the euro area, but also more broadly in the EU. Economic policy making will become much more rules-based and will take much better into account the spillover effects to other member states. Neither the European Union nor the euro area will become a federal system, but they will be much more than a sum of its member states through deeper economic policy integration and reinforced economic governance. By the way, many Americans, I recall, think that EMU, and you can find this often in the economics or political economy textbooks also, many seem to think that EMU stands for European Monetary Union. That's not precisely correct. In fact, it means economic and monetary union. And what we are doing with this reform is that we are now finally creating a true and functional economic union to supplement the already strong monetary union. In other words, what we are doing in Europe now is strengthening our economic pillar and in the EMU filling E with life, and it is indeed high time to do so. Ladies and gentlemen, before concluding, let me now still say a few words about the specific role of the euro, which often tends to be forgotten in the daily commentary of the financial media. The economic rationale of the euro was, on the one hand, to enhance the functioning of the markets in a very integrated economic system, and on the other hand, to provide economic and monetary stability. It has done both. The euro has substantially helped cross-border trade in both goods and services in Europe. It has also been a stabilizing factor and prevented the all-too-familiar currency crisis with sky-high interest rates, as well as eventual devaluations of the fixed but adjustable systems like the European monetary system in the past. With the types of shocks we have experienced since August 2007, an EMS system would have been highly destabilizing and would have most likely broken down. I have some personal experience of this because I worked as a young member of parliament as chief of staff of the Finnish Prime Minister Esko Aho in the early 1990s, when we had to face the crisis, clean up the mess that the previous government created, and face the crisis of the 1991-93, which was a very deep economic recession in the country, I know best. And then the Finnish currency, markka, was brought down by several factors, including George Soros, who put down not only the pound sterling, but also the Finnish markka. And it was not his fault, but in the end, we faced unemployment of almost 20% and have to go through a very deep structural change. And that's a typical lesson of a small state in Europe. Now, in this crisis, the euro has served as a protective shield, and we are now rebounding without having to go so deep as we went in the course of the 1990s. And that experience is very deep among the policymakers in the smaller states and why not larger states in Europe. And I think it is important to take this into account and not underestimate this experience, because we feel that with the euro we have a protective shield, and it has greatly stabilized our economy in Europe. Of course, the single currency made it easier for some member states to end up in unsustainable credit booms and unsustainable private and public debt levels. Similarly, the adjustment after the bursting of the bubble is probably more demanding in the absence of exchange rate flexibility. But one should not exaggerate these aspects. The United Kingdom and many so-called new member states managed to create much bigger credit bubbles, banking crises, and public finance problems than many prudent euro area member states. And if you look at the speed at which Irish unit labour costs have adjusted, the exchange rate adjustment alone does not seem to be decisive. And by the Finnish example, it also has quite significant economic and social costs. While the reforms which I have briefly described benefit the Union as a whole, they are especially important for the euro area. Therefore, the coordination must be closer among these countries than the rest. And for instance, the sanctions for bad behavior must be tougher for the euro area member states. So, ladies and gentlemen, to conclude, macroeconomic developments over the past year have produced rather strong evidence that our policies are working in spite of a very difficult starting point. A recovery is underway. It has taken hold and is progressing now. While it has been export-led up to now, domestic demand has started to contribute increasingly. Moreover, the labour market is gradually improving. No doubt, Europe still faces significant economic challenges. Global competition has not diminished in the years of economic crisis, rather the opposite. Unemployment is still unacceptably high in many parts of Europe. Our populations are aging rapidly, and we face the challenge of securing our energy supplies in a safe and environmentally sustainable manner. But let me be clear, the euro is not on the list of problems. Instead, it is an essential part of the solution. It contributes to growth by enhancing cross-border economic activity and competition, and it is essential for macroeconomic and monetary stability. Lastly, let me recall that the euro is not just a technical monetary arrangement, but rather the core political project of the European Union. As such, it is a symbol of our political will and determination to work together for our common good. And that is a further reason why it is worth taking Europe seriously when we say that we are ready to do whatever it takes to defend the euro and financial stability in Europe. Thank you very much for your attention.
So, good morning. I was asked just to give a brief comment and maybe help facilitate the discussion. So let me do that. I think all these comments, I would just make one sort of basic point, which I think the debate about the euro is important to understand that the issues of the euro, it seems to me at least, are more a reflection of Europe's broader economic challenges than their cause. And I think often the focus on the euro per se doesn't, get to the more fundamental points. The euro is going to reflect how Europe deals with its economic challenges, not just the construction of the euro itself. And so if you step back a moment and reflect on how Europe has been doing, I mean, it still brings considerable strengths to the world economy and to its own competitive position. Justin mentioned the books we've just done. I mean, if you compare the EU as a region with other world regions, say North America or Latin America or Africa or Asia, you know, the EU is still the number one trader in the world. It's the number one destination for foreign direct investment in the world. It's the number one source of foreign direct investment in the world. It is a major provider of capital, not only to the United States, but to lots of regions around the world. It brings considerable strengths. It's in a better position, I think, than often the media and political debates give it. I think one striking development of importance to the United States is that over the last 15 years, the EU has maintained its share of global exports at about 19%, whereas the United States share has gone down 6 percentage points to only about 12%, and Japan's share has gone down equally about 6 percentage points to only about 8%. So the EU, on balance, has withstood this global competition better than the other major advanced economies. And if you look at sort of what the EU is exporting, it does tend to be many goods that the rising powers want. So I think there's a challenge here the EU is presenting to actually other major advanced economies in terms of their export possibilities. The president has, you know, pitched the idea we have to double our exports, and that's a good goal. But at the moment, that's not where the U.S. is heading. And so the EU provides, I think, some benchmark of competition and comparison also with us. The last strength that seems striking from the last survey we did is that last year, back to the point about Europe rebounding, American companies earned $186 billion in Europe. That was a historic high, not just a rebound. It's the all-time high in terms of profits by U.S. companies in Europe. So somebody thinks Europe's worth investing in and is actually making a lot of money. And I should say that European companies in the United States last year also did rather well. So if you look at some of those leading indicators, they say there's some confidence in what's happening and moving on. But clearly there are some very severe challenges that Europe has to face. And I think back to the point about the euro reflecting that challenge. Ole was talking about how the firefighters are doing with the euro crisis, and that this permanent stability mechanism is in place and on its way in 2013. But if I may, that seems to me a bit like, you know, the fire is raging right now, and down the street, around the corner, downtown somewhere, you're building a really good, glitzy new fire truck that'll put out the fire as soon as it can get there, but it's going to take a while as the fire is still going. And I think this is sort of the current challenge of Europe, that Portugal now, again, having a challenge. And the sort of the case-by-case management of the unfolding crisis hasn't really, convinced the markets that European leaders have got their hands around this crisis. So I think 2013 sounds good, but getting from here to there is going to be a challenge. So I'm afraid Ole's going to have still a lot of work to do between now and then. I'm not sure you're at the end point. I can Greece and Ireland are still actually in some trouble. The question will be, after these bailouts, what is the next possibility of dealing with these countries if they have to come back again for further support, even though the bailout packages have been put in place? So I think there's still a challenge there. It underscores his main point that you have a common currency area without a common economic policy. And that discrepancy, in the end, it helps to drive Europe apart. And many of the euro's challenges are because the underlying competitive differences with among your EU member states is pulling and tearing at that sense of commonness. It seems, to be shorthand, that you have sort of the northern tier countries, all, you know, I'd say core Europe, northern Europe, doing pretty well, actually, having gotten out of the recession and moving forward, Poland even almost in that class. But then you have the peripheral countries for very different reasons. Either of them have their own problems, not making the curve in terms of not only the crisis, but looking to their competitive position for the future. And then you have, besides Poland, the other sort of eastern countries that had emerged out of communism were on a pretty good track until the recession hit, and now the question is whether the model they had been on is relevant now to the future economy they're facing. And what does that mean then for the solidarity that is supposed to be behind the European Union? What does that imply? How do you manage the competitive dispersion? And I think that's going to be a major challenge for the euro, but also for the European Union. And that leads to a different issue not mentioned, but I do believe is a serious issue facing Europe today, and that's the demographic challenges. I only mentioned it briefly, but I just want to underscore it. Europe is aging and shrinking. If you look at the projections of population and the kinds of workers and so on it has a serious problem maintaining its competitive position. It would have to double its current immigration to halt its population decline. It would have to triple its current immigration to simply maintain the working population that it has. And it would have to quintuple, five times, its immigration rates to maintain the worker-elderly ratios it has today. This is a severe challenge. At a time when Europe still is the main source or destination of all of migrants in the world, but they tend to be the unskilled migrants. So Europe, at a time when it needs people, it's getting people, but it's getting unskilled people. And it doesn't have in place then a pan-Europe talent strategy that would encourage skills, high-skilled migrants, first of all, training those that do come, training them up, training its own population to maintain its competitiveness. There's a human capacity issue in Europe that I think will start, that is already affecting lots of other elements of competitiveness. So I just want to put that out as this is not a problem of the euro, but it's a problem that will affect the euro and many other institutions of Europe over time. So finally, the question is, what does that mean for the EU per se? And the Commission, you know, and member states have put forward this Europe 2020 strategy. The question is, if the EU is going to be value added, then it is more than the sum of its parts. That means 2 + 2 = 5 if the EU is a success. Right now, I think it would be hard to argue that 2 + 2 = 5 in Europe today. The Commission has put forward this important 2020 strategy. It has many interesting good elements in it. But the last strategy, the Lisbon strategy, foundered not on the good goals, but the fact that it couldn't be implemented by the member states, who either refused or unable to do the real work that would make that real. So my 2020 in the book that we have is not the Commission strategy. I believe it's Europe's closing window. I believe if you project the trends that I've discussed, Europe has about a decade to reposition itself for the global economy it's facing. If it doesn't get that right, it's going to face some really severe competitive pressures that could further accelerate this pulling apart among its member states. So it has to get the recovery right. I think Olli's working very hard to do that. It has to improve its productivity, which is really not where it should be. It has to tap the full single market. The single market is the bedrock of Europe's competitive position in a world of continental-sized players. It's trying. I know the Single Market Act has been advanced, but it really has to do this. It provides European companies with a base by which they can compete in this type of world. It has to unleash what we call the sleeping giant of the services economy. Europe and the United States are really the only big services economies in the world. Europe has considerable strengths there, but is embroiled in debates about that that are hampering it from unleashing its full potential that could create a lot of jobs. All the net job growth in the EU in the last 15 years are in the services area, all of it, all of them. So not addressing that is not a job creation strategy. I mentioned the talent strategy. That relates to innovation as a knowledge economy. Someone coming from Finland would know that better than many. That is, you know, ultimately where Europe's competitive advantage will rest. So the innovation union that's proposed is very important, but people are the ones who innovate. So I end where I try to stress that the human challenge for Europe is quite severe. And how Europe deals with that, I think, will start to address lots of other issues that it faces as well. So there you are, and I hope we have a good discussion. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Dan, for these great remarks. I think I'm going to abuse the privilege of being the chair to ask a question, and maybe it would be a follow-up on one Dan said in the beginning of his remarks, the firefighter analogy. So the question of the medium-term strategy, we know something definitive and great is coming for 2013, but what are we doing in the meantime? That was more or less Dan's question. And I would add my own question more on the very short term, which is, could you tell us about one of the key questions of this crisis, which is the situation of the banks, of European banks. We had a round of stress tests a year and a half ago, which were considered not to be very conclusive, or actually at least which didn't convince the markets. Could you tell us about the current round of its date and its likely what we hope to achieve through them?
Thank you. With pleasure. And in fact, as you refer to this, say, short-term versus long-term, or short-term firefighting versus long-term growth and governance issues, it is perhaps true that we will have the permanent European stability mechanism only from mid-2013 onwards. That will be kind of a brand new fire brigade car, while we still have, for the moment, also a fire brigade. Maybe that's kind of a pre-owned car of fire brigade. But we have to make best out of that, and it's worked in the Irish case, and I have no doubt that we can make it make it to work also in the Portuguese case. As regards the banking sector, you're right that this is really the second key dimension of the crisis, the current states of the crisis, in a sense that I think we have already for some time been in a phase of the crisis which is kind of a severely intertwined combination of a sovereign debt crisis and banking sector fragilities. And you cannot solve one without solving the other. You have to tackle both. And that's why the current round of bank stress tests is so critical and crucial for reinforcing confidence in the European economy. The round has started, and it is now conducted under the auspices, under the guidance of the brand new European Banking Authority, which started its work in January. So one big difference this time around will be that while last year in the latest round of the stress tests, the national authorities had the sole right of implementation of the tests. Now we have, and there was a very loose coordination only among the 27. Now we have a European supervisory authority, which has a significant possibility of significant powers of oversight and guidance of the process. And I trust that the implementation of the stress tests this time will be more uniform and more rigorous, which was the handicap last time, even if 24 or 22 of the member states did it right with full rigor. We had some weaknesses, biggest of them, Ireland, and that eroded the credibility of the stress tests. One final point still in this context, it is absolutely essential that all those member states who have reason to assume that they have needs of restructuring and especially recapitalization of some of the vulnerable banks when the results are revealed, they should now already prepare credible backstops, national backstops, to prepare for possible recapitalization in the case that such kind of vulnerable banks are found. Mm-hmm. And this process is now going on, and we are going to have a discussion on this in a few weeks in the ECOFIN Council of Finance Ministers, where we should peer review how things are done in different member states in this regard.
Thanks. I'll now open to the floor. We have a bit more than half an hour, and so we'll take the questions by rounds of three. So please identify yourself when you ask the question and make sure it's a question. Sir.
Yes, my name is Javed Hamid.
Thanks.
Javed Hamid. I'm a consultant to the World Bank. I have a question. You mentioned that there will be effort for better enforcement, and you mentioned the word sanctions for those who do not follow the rules. Can you elaborate a little bit on what kind of sanctions and how do you make those sanctions effective, please? Thank you.
Thanks. Sunjin, here.
Good morning. My name is Sunjin Choi. Commissioner, could I follow your commenting on Spain? And I read IMF report. Also, this morning's FT mentioned Spain is decoupling from the three countries. It is true. However, what I'm not sure about savings bank. And yes, the savings bank in Madrid is okay, but Catalonia is not the same case. And B, unemployment in Spain is quite high. And C, and the Spanish stock market, one of the worst performing stock market in the world. So that, I'm not sure. I'll be interested in your views on that issues. And with regard to Portugal, with the departure of Axel Weber, now ECB has more leeway to continue to purchase of sovereign bonds. That means ECB will play more important role in upcoming Portuguese negotiation. Thank you.
Thanks. And so the gentleman in the blue tie. Thanks.
Yes, my name is Anthony Odi. I'm also a freelance consultant connected to the World Bank. Commissioner, building on what was just said about the stress tests, obviously in some of the countries, unsound banking practices, weak banking regulation are a major part of the story. Beyond the stress tests, what does Brussels have in mind for levelling upwards standards of regulation of the banks and the countries? That's the softball question. Just to put a little spin on it, You hear people saying that the bailout for Greece is really designed to give German and other banks enough time to prepare for a default, which people say is going to come anyway. Would you like to give us your comment on that?
Thanks. Oli, why don't you answer these three questions, and Dan, if you have something to add, you'll be welcome to do so.
Thank you. First, as regards the new sanctions regime, The point here is that the key point really is that we will have to have sanctions at our disposal at much earlier stages in the policymaking cycle than in the past. In the past, one reason why the sanctions were not effective was that they would have been triggered only when the damage was already done, and then it would not make too much sense to have financial sanctions. Now, instead of only having the sanctions at the very late stage, we are bringing them forward to the preventive arm of the Stability and Growth Pact. There are still sanctions in the so-called corrective arm, but we are bringing them to the preventive arm, implying that once we can identify, or once we face a situation where a member state is deviating from the path of prudent fiscal policy making, deviating from the rules of the pact, then it is our responsibility as the Commission to propose to the Council to take sanctions against a member state, which would in fact be tightened gradually, so that first you would have to pay an interest-bearing deposit. It could turn into a non-interest-bearing deposit, and finally to a fine in case a member state is not taking corrective action. And in a way, this is designed less for the cases like Greece, when it was already in the crisis, rather for, say, cases like Finland or Luxembourg, if they would start deviating from responsible fiscal policy. For instance, if after the elections, parliamentary elections in the country I know best, in the coming weeks there would be a new government which would propose a budget for next year of, say, 5% fiscal deficit instead of 1% fiscal deficit, I would have to propose sanctions through the Commission to the Council, which Finland could avoid if it were to take corrective action and revise its budget for next year. So the whole point is that it has to trigger early enough, and it has to be gradual, so that the country can avoid these sanctions taking place. Of course, it's not only the financial sanction. I mean, it's relatively modest, some significant, but will not turn any member state to bankruptcy or default. But it's also a signal to the markets, to the investors, and it is also a political and reputational sanction if this were to happen. I certainly hope that the country I know best will avoid this fate, but that's up to the coalition talks and the new government to avoid it. Concerning Spain, you are right that Spain has significant challenges. There's very high unemployment, and that's why the labour market reform is particularly important, and it is now moving forward. And I trust that it will have an impact on the very high unemployment in Spain. One of the problems in Spain has been a very dualistic labour market, and Spain should be able to reduce this dualism and improve the employability of its labour markets. As to the savings banks, there is a very determined restructuring going on. For instance, the number of savings banks is reduced from 46 to around 15 through mergers, and there is a clear remedial plan of recapitalization through the so-called FROB, which is the Spanish national backstop, and this plan is now being implemented by the Spanish authorities. Concerning the financial sector regulation, we are working together with our international partners in G20, and we have agreed on the new Basel III capital requirements, capital adequacy requirements, and my colleague Michel Barnier is shortly translating these Basel III standards into the form of legislation, and then the Commission will, in the coming weeks or months, make a proposal to the Member States how we translate the G20 Basel III standards into the European legislation. We will play by the G20 rules, and we will implement this in due course and in the time frame that is foreseen in the commitments undertaken in this international context. Here I want to say that we have already done one major reform which has been implemented, to which I referred already indirectly. In other words, we have reformed the system of financial supervision, in fact both microprudential supervision, and created an entity for macroprudential supervision. January this January, three supervisory authorities at the European level started, one for banks, another one for insurance, and the third one for securities. And on top of that, we created what's called the European Systemic Risk Board, which is presided by or chaired by President Jean-Claude Trichet of the ECB, which combines the forces of these European regulators, national regulators and central banks, the Commission, and which has the task of preemptively assessing risks to macrofinancial stability in Europe. I'm a member of that board, and I find that its creation very important, and it will significantly supplement the work the Commission is doing in order to identify macroeconomic imbalances. So in the past, we had no system of preemptively identifying macroeconomic imbalances or macrofinancial stability risks. Now we have tasked both the Commission and the European Systemic Risk Board to do this. I'm sure that we will be able to do better in terms of crisis prevention in the future because of these new instruments. Finally, on Greece, I'm aware of the public debate and recent statements as regards the debt sustainability of Greece. We do not see debt restructuring as an option. Instead, we are engaged into a revised and updated debt sustainability analysis, which we will do profoundly with the IMF, and we will present it in due course to the member states of the European Union, and I guess Dominic Strauss-Kahn to the IMF board. That is a regular exercise, and we want to, of course, in the context of the reviewing of the program, which we do every quarter. So we want to assess now, next time around in May, the growth prospects of Greece as well as tax revenues, and we will in that context also assess the overall implementation of the program, which so far at least has been on track. And in that context, as I said, we will also do a debt sustainability analysis of Greece.
Thanks. We'll take another round of questions right here next to you.
This is Alex Brutier with German TV N24. A follow-up on your last remarks. Just to understand, with the permanent mechanism in place after 2013, is it your view that possible haircuts in the case of Greece or others is more likely after 2013? And also going back to the German question, how deep do you think is the German banking crisis, or are the German banks' weaknesses? And how do you think, particularly the exposure to sovereign debt in the so-called PIGS countries, has played a role in handling the current crisis?
Thanks. At the back over there.
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioner Wren. My name is Patrick Flanagan. I'm a student at Zeiss, Johns Hopkins University. On Monday, the IMF announced that Ireland's GDP growth this year will be cut in half.
Can you speak a little bit louder, please?
Sorry. On Monday, the IMF announced that Ireland's GDP growth would be cut in half, and then on Tuesday, the expectations on Ireland meeting its debt to GDP ratio this year. It's unexpected that Ireland will meet its debt agreements. Do you expect greater austerity measures in Ireland in the coming year? And secondly, are you optimistic about the interest rate on Irish debts being lowered by the EU?
Brian Beery from Europolitics. Just wanted to follow up on your remark that regarding Greece, we don't see debt restructuring as an option. Why is that not an option? Could you just elaborate, and not just for Greece, but for Ireland as well? Why is the Commission being so adamant that debt restructuring cannot happen.
Thanks. We have three questions. Commissioner Wren.
Thank you. So the small talk is over. So we start with Ireland, in fact, because these two others are interrelated, more interrelated. Concerning Ireland, it was known when the program was designed, the EU IMF program, which is based on the economic recovery program of Ireland itself, that there will be in the beginning a negative impact on economic growth before it starts to rebound and gain strength again. Now it is essential that the Irish government will stick to the program as it was agreed with its European and international partners in order to achieve the fiscal deficit or reduce the fiscal deficit to 3% by 2015. And we have analyzed and calculated very carefully the path of Irish fiscal path of adjustment, and taking into account that there are also some positive signs in terms of export growth and industrial production, I'm confident that Ireland will be able to overcome its challenges. In this regard, the recent conduct of bank stress tests is a very important milestone. It was done properly and profoundly. The Irish authorities worked very closely with the Commission, ECB and the IMF, and we agreed on the strategy forward. And these stress tests, as you probably know, revealed weaknesses of or needs of recapitalization of 24 billion euros. The program for EU IMF program for Ireland was designed so that it has the maximum capacity of 35 billion euros to accommodate the problems of the banking sector. 24 billion is clearly within the frame of the program, and in fact it is very close to the central scenario on which the growth and fiscal forecast of the program was designed. In other words, that was based on the needs of recapitalization of 25 billion euros. The fact that the result of 24 billion euros is close to 25 billion euros, the central scenario, is accidental. It was not designed to be so. It was done on the basis of very careful bottom-up empirical work. But in any case, the result is in the frame of the program and, in fact, is relatively close to the central scenario of the program, which was designed last November. So in that sense, the Irish program is on track, and at least initially the results of the stress tests and the strategy of restructuring and recapitalization of the banking sector has been relatively well received by the markets as well. Concerning the discussion on debt restructuring of Greece or any other countries, we see that in a still fragile situation in the European economy, it is a high risk that debt restructuring would cause a chain reaction through the banking sector, and thus having a serious negative impact on the capacity of lending of the banks and other financial institutions, which would, of course, have negative ramifications to the channeling of credit to enterprises, households and individual citizens, and could thus endanger the ongoing economic recovery. Moreover, nobody should underestimate the risk of contagion effect to other sovereigns. I recall one day a
minister saying that those who continuously speak about debt restructuring in public are causing damage to my country. A minister who has done very determined and important work in order to reform that country. Concerning Greece, as regards your question related to haircuts more likely or before or after 2013, I would not want to enter into that discussion. I just say that in the current EFSF, private sector involvement is not foreseen, not included, while in the future permanent ESM private sector involvement is introduced as a possibility, not automatic, but as a possibility, and it will be, if needed, done according to the IMF rules and practices. The German banking sector is recovering, and